Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. I'm Sarah Bankson, Deputy Director of RTP. Today, we're happy to host two experts as they discuss the issue of state child welfare agencies using the Social Security benefits of foster care children. Maureen Flatley is a subject matter expert in child welfare and child exploitation with a particular expertise in government reform and oversight. We're also joined by Shoshana Weissman, Director of Digital Media and Technology and Innovation Fellow at R Street Institute. Thank you both for being with us today. Our listeners can read more about our speakers at regproject.org. With that, I'll hand it over to you, Shoshana.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to talk about this today. So to start, from my work in technology policy and looking into the identity theft issues of a lot of age verification proposals, you know, when you have to upload government ID, your social security number, stuff like that to different platforms, there's real implications for child identity theft, which is a really, really big problem. But when I was diving in here, I found something that I couldn't believe, that a lot of state governments steal money from orphans. So I'm going to read a piece, a short paragraph from Imprint News that did a really, really great piece on this. And then we'll dive in and figure out how the heck this happened. So Imprint News reported that nationwide, an estimated 5% of all children and youth in foster care qualify for Social Security Administration disability and survivor benefits. But when they receive them, child welfare agencies often intercept those payments that can amount to more than $900 a month. An investigation by the Marshall Project and the National Public Radio estimated that in 2018 alone, child welfare agencies in 49 states and the District of Columbia seized at least $165 million owed to foster youth and used the money to pay for the cost of their placements in the child welfare system. Thankfully, since this report, Arizona, Colorado, New Hampshire, and Washington, D.C. passed some comprehensive reforms to stop these practices. And a lot of other states stepped in for different levels of reforms. But I think to start, Maureen, what the heck is happening here? Why are states stealing money from literal orphans?
Well, I think the simple answer is because they can. And I think it's fair to say that this is a practice that obviously started a long time ago. And it was just something that came about over a period of time as states struggled to underwrite the cost of child welfare programs. And I think it was probably a function of what we call revenue maximization, where when a child enters care, states basically do an inventory of benefits that that child may be eligible for. So if the child has severe special needs or educational deficits or other kinds of extraordinary requirements, they look for ways to pay for those additional services. I first discovered this many, many years ago when it was clear to me that a particular county in California was actually issuing multiple Social Security numbers to the same kids so that they could make multiple Title IV claims to the feds. But the Social Security piece of it surfaced later. And the thing that I really want to emphasize is that the states are capturing this money without the permission of the children's parents, who are sort of, in many instances, sort of the predicate beneficiary. They are often not even using the money for the kids' care. It goes into a general fund. One of the most pernicious aspects of this is that in many states, there are a significant number of children in the system that the states can't even locate, and yet they're collecting money for those kids. So it's a practice that's gone on for a long time. There have been a number of efforts to stop it in Congress because, you know, obviously, although child welfare is viewed as a state law issue, there's a huge amount of federal money that flows into the state systems. And the states actually opposed the suspension of this practice. And incredibly, Congress went along with it. So it's a longstanding practice, and one that was sort of ginned up to other, you know, to bolster the funding that they already received from the feds in the states.
So I love that you brought up so many things I really want to dive into. I think I don't even know where to start. I think we'll start with maybe, so the state agencies were doing child identity theft on behalf of themselves to steal money from kids. Like, that's something that you saw 100%. In your work.
In any other context, several aspects of this would probably be considered criminal behavior. So in other words, they're applying for federal benefits. I'll give you an example. A family lost custody of their child. Mom and dad were both in the grips of a mental health crisis. They were both receiving SSDI in the state that had custody of the child, realized it, and without their permission or anyone's permission, they tapped into eligibility for the child. So the child started receiving significant benefits. Of course, as far as we know, he never saw any of that money. In any other context, I'm fairly certain that would be considered theft. Then you have the...
it's theft. You're stealing money from
then
kids.
You have the issue of the fact that these children do not have trustees. And so if this were, say, senior citizens, and most states have elder care laws that are even more aggressive than their child welfare laws, these kids should each have a trustee who is their representative payee, who can maintain control over the funds and keep the funds sequestered for that child. For instance, let's say a child has significant unmet medical needs or psychiatric needs as a result of whatever disability the parent had. The money should be put in a trust so that when that child needs extraordinary services, the trust can then offset the cost of those services. What happens now is that there's no trust of any kind. The child often receives zero services. As I said before, sometimes the state doesn't even know where the child is. And the state is using that money to build baseball fields and buy police cars. So there are really kind of two problems here. At the front end, you have what you and I have certainly looked at together as straight up identity theft. This is not the person who is eligible for the services. If it's a child, there's no arm's length third party guardian or trustee. And then the money is not being used for the purpose that it was designed. So really what we have here is kind of a double-edged scam that the states have continued without really any serious pushback from Congress. I mean, there have been a couple of efforts on the part of Congress, as you and I have talked about, to suspend this practice, but nothing that ever amounted to much because the states came forward and said, no, we really need that money. And so what ends up happening is that you have 22,000 kids a year age out of the foster care system, completely destitute, most of them medically neglected, educationally neglected, dentally neglected, psychologically neglected. They can't afford to rent an apartment or get a car. It's really astounding that this has been permitted to continue.
Oh, definitely. When I learned about this through you and through the research here, I was just so astonished that this could go on. And there's a couple of good government principles that are being violated here too. Like one is that, and I'm sure you've heard of this one too, that it's just a good idea that when government uses taxes to pay for something, it should only go to that one thing and it shouldn't be in a general fund. That you want a good means ends fit where you can have it because it ties resources to what they're supposed to go for. And obviously that's not happening here. And another one is, you know, generally I'm worried about the federal government and being involved in state affairs. This is not one of those cases, but in part because the Social Security funds are supposed to go to the parents, to the families. That's, you know, that's why it's there, but the money is being totally misused. Like, this is not what the money is there for. So I don't have an issue with the federal government stepping in. Like, I'm glad states are, and that's great, but I'm not against additional protections to make sure this doesn't happen. And another thing too, is just, you know, I'm someone who tends to be pretty skeptical of government. Like, I tend to question a lot, but I never would have ever imagined that states and the government would see kids who are in these positions and abuse their financial resources like this. Like, this is something that's just so far beyond my imagination that even when I've talked to other people who are very skeptical of government, they're still like, what the heck? Like, how could this even happen? But I think you bring up a really good way to round out that not only is it happening, like, to some degree, it's happening a lot, and it's happening in ridiculous ways. Like, you know, applying for multiple social security numbers so they can get more benefits and still, you know, send it to the state. One thing I want to dig in with you a little bit more on is that I think one thing that makes it so egregious is what you started talking about, where basically when kids age out of foster care, they often end up homeless. They have really poor outcomes. They've just had hard lives and a lot of difficulties, mm-hmm. which makes it all worse. But you've done a lot of work over the years with foster youth. And have you seen how this has affected them and cases maybe where they could have had better outcomes if they had the resources that that they properly were supposed to have?
I mean, this has been one of the banes of my professional life for a couple of decades now, because I see, and I was a foster parent in DC for 10 years. And so I would also say that I've seen this up close and personal in a very different way. But what is an outrage to me? Well, first of all, let's go back to what you said about federal versus state. You know, everybody views child welfare as a state law issue. However, I would posit that dating back to the orphan trains in the 1850s, there has been a fundamentally interstate component to child welfare that was then really kind of cemented when federal dollars started flowing to the states. The Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act was created in 1974, and that kind of codified all this stuff from a federal perspective, and the states had to comply with that to get the federal part of their share. So state child welfare is funded by a matrix of both federal and state funds, and of course now the Social Security money. While I'm not a big government person, and while I certainly think that it's interesting in this case that the states have stepped up to mitigate this practice before the feds actually have, there is some movement in Congress. I do think that it might be the moment. You know, there's always a moment for issues when they finally ripen adequately and people start to take them seriously. And I think we are maybe at that point in Congress. But at the end of the day, this is a Dickensian scenario because, you know, as you know, I've known probably thousands of foster youth at this point. And what they would all say is that, you know, there was nothing good about being in foster care. They didn't get the things they needed. I can't think of a single foster youth I've seen age out that didn't have some dire financial circumstances that was a victim of identity theft. You and I talk about this all the time. The incidence of identity theft of kids in foster care is dramatically higher than the general population because so many people handle their identifying information. And looking at the Social Security scam is like the hyper example of that. You know, here these folks have access to their Social Security numbers, but there isn't even the patina of effort to create a third party payee, to create a guardianship, to create any kind of trust situation. I've consulted over the years with some of the world's leading experts on trust and estate law, and they all consider this to be an illegal taking of these benefits for the kids. So at the end of the day, first of all, many of the kids don't even know this is going on. They have no idea the state is collecting, you know, $900 to $1,200 a month in their names, and they're, you know, not going to the dentist. They don't have glasses. They're in desperate need of educational support. None of that is happening, okay, even in sort of the best case scenario. So ultimately, when you look at the way that these kids are treated, it's not much different from the chattel that was the orphan trains, where kids were basically just dropped off in the middle of nowhere. The other thing is that in addition to the 22,000 kids who age out every year, and that number has remained consistent since the late 1990s when we did the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which was a massive overhaul of child welfare policy, passed in a very bipartisan way, actually. But then you also have roughly 1 in 9 adoptions from foster care fail. Those kids re-enter the system. Then you have another component of kids who are adopted internationally who are also going into foster care. So the system has become this kind of basket of failure. I mean, I don't think it's ever really been very successful. And I would, you know, I would admit and argue that the states have a tough job, but at the same time, if they were running a hospital system and this percentage of patients were dying, or they were misappropriating, say, patients' insurance money, I can assure you that no one would tolerate it. And so the fact that we've allowed this system, which was designed to care for literally the most vulnerable population of children in this country, to operate so carelessly and so exploitively, well, you know, it's like I always say, Shoshana, this isn't necessarily Congress's fault. This is our fault because we've all kind of let this happen, and it really needs to stop.
Oh, definitely. I was actually talking with a friend in the South who was telling me that he had adopted a few kids, and some of them have severe disabilities. And he was a little bit surprised that he wasn't getting some benefits along with it just to help with their care. And I told him he should go look into this because I wonder if even when they get adopted that this is still happening. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's still the case. It's so astonishing that we've – but you're right. It's astonishing we've let this happen and that states haven't fixed this issue. But I'd also like to get into, I know one thing you talk about that always stuns me too. So much of this is so new to me, and I know that you're used to it, and I know that you know it's surprising, but it's stunning to me that not only are we losing foster kids at an alarming rate in the system, that they just disappear and we might never find them again or know what mm-hmm. happened to them, but that even when that's happening, the government is still trying to find ways to milk them for money. Mm-hmm. There has to be a level of realizing something is horribly wrong in that case, mm-hmm. but does government just see it as like, oh, well, we need the money? Is that all it comes down to?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I use the example of, there was a little girl in Florida called Rilia Wilson who was in foster care in the system. She was adopted at a relatively young age by a single mom, and the benefits were flowing, adoption, subsidy payments, whatever benefits she was eligible for. And after a period of time, the neighbors realized that no one was seeing the child. She wasn't in school. She wasn't playing in the yard. And so an investigation was triggered, and people realized that she had basically been missing for 5 years, but the parent was continuing to collect subsidy payments. This triggered an audit in Florida, looking to see what other kids they couldn't find. And this happened about 15 years ago. I can't remember the exact number, but let's say it was about 20% of kids in the system that the state couldn't even locate for a variety of reasons. Some of the kids were dead. Some of the kids had left the system. Some of the kids were runaways. In Rilia's case, the belief was that she had been murdered. I don't believe that a body was ever discovered. But, we see this all the time. You see this all the time in fatality cases where kids are literally deceased and yet the benefits still flow. So, the states have taken the attitude, and I don't mean to necessarily bash the states in general, because I think it's sort of a child welfare agency problem, not a whole state problem. But they're just, leave us alone. This is a hard job. You know, I live in Massachusetts now, and we've had an alarming number of child fatalities in the state. And we've been trying to institute an independent foster care review program, which would be one way to be able to do an inventory of what the child, is the child getting the benefits they need? Is the child alive? Do we know where the child is? And over and over and over again, our, you know, progressive variety of governors over the past 20 years that I've lived here have pushed back on that. So it's one of those issues, and you know, I hate to generalize, but I think that we don't really care enough about the condition of foster children in this country because there are a lot of issues. And but this is one of the most egregious, one of the most obvious, and quite frankly, one that we can fix.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, there's legislation in Congress that I think takes a measured approach. And thankfully, states have been starting to stop this practice. I've even talked to people in other states who know this is happening and they're trying to stop it, of course, because if you know about it, of course you want it to stop. But it's just almost a matter of fact that this stuff is going on. Aside from basically telling states, no, you can't steal their Social Security money, are there other fixes in this realm that you think are going to be helpful?
Well, I think, you know, this is something you and I have been talking about and writing about a little bit. You know, just the general carelessness around the kids' identifying information. I mean, so imagine how angry you would be if you were, a, say, 20-year-old who aged out of the foster care system anywhere in the country, only to discover that, A, while you were in the system, someone stole your identity and ruined whatever credit you might have, so you can't buy that first car, you can't get that first apartment. And then on top of it, you find out that your state had collected $150,000 or $200,000 in benefits on your behalf, but you had never been to the dentist. You had chronic mental health issues. You were, you know, educationally deprived. I mean, but that's what happens. That's what happens all the time. Yeah. And I mean, even just the regular subsidy payments that the state gets to support kids in the system is actually not really being directed carefully enough. I mean, I use the analogy of a hospital all the time. You know, if you're a foster kid and you end up in an emergency room in a hospital with some serious illness, you don't move from the emergency room to the operating room until, you know, your case has been vetted, the information about you has been conveyed, you're covered by HIPAA. But in the child welfare system, which is kind of like an emergency room full of gunshot victims on a Saturday night, there's none of that real care. The system uses the privacy shield that is supposed to be protecting the kids to really conceal their own activities. And so, in other words, the privacy shield has served not to protect the privacy of the children, but to cover up the malfeasance or poor performance of the state agencies themselves. So there's really a quality control issue here that is baffling to me. I mean, I've worked all over the country. I've been to every orphanage in Romania. They had, and I say this with a completely straight face, they had better records about the children in their care in Romanian orphanages 20 years ago than we have in the child welfare system sometimes. And, you know, obviously they had a lot of other factors they were dealing with and it was, you know, harsh and terrible, but they had systems. And so, you know, there's really no excuse for not creating a more child-specific approach to their privacy, their effectiveness. We have, you know, this just came up, funnily enough, in another conversation before I got on the call. Someone was asking me about the impact of the Dobbs decision. And I said, you know, there have been a lot of unintended consequences of the Dobbs decision, one of which is that more kids will enter the foster care system. If women decide that they can't parent a child, then there are only really two options, a private adoption or the child ends up being committed to the system involuntarily because mom tries to parent but just can't do it. And so while states are trying to lower the cost of child welfare in part by what is an admirable national movement to move children to either keep families together in the first place, whatever that involves, or to move them into kinship care, which is a family-based approach, or adoption if that's the last resort. But this sort of careless bookkeeping is a troubling and problematic part of that system. And of course, when families adopt from the system, to your earlier point, they're often not aware of these benefits. Some of them just change the kid's social security number as a way to protect their forward-looking identity. So it's just not, it's not a practice that's been well known, but I think it speaks to the larger issue of why aren't we doing a better job with this in general? You know, we're talking a lot about privacy right now, and certainly you and I share a concern about age verification and various aspects of the tech conversation, but right under our noses in all 50 states and DC, we have systems of children in the care of the government who are being exploited and neglected. And so, of course, you know, I always say the irony is while the states are suing the tech companies, accusing them of all kinds of nefarious activity, they're all being sued too for a variety of reasons related to their poor performance. So I just, there's really no excuse for it.
And like we've talked about, the IRS isn't telling parents when they know that their kids' identities are stolen and used for tax fraud. And the IRS IG report literally just says, well, kids don't have tax accounts, so we're not going to bother telling them or trying to track them down at all. And the Social Security Administration doesn't check socials before issuing them to babies. So they're literally issuing histories of fraud and abuse to babies. There was a really great story in the Deseret, I think like a week or two ago about it. And it was helpful to have an illustrative example of like, this is what's happening and this is what we're seeing here. That's exactly it. I think we're both frustrated that sometimes the focus is on tech rather than what the government's actually really in control of here. From the states that have stepped up here on these laws, New Hampshire, DC, Arizona, Colorado, I know you've worked in a lot of places. I'm sure not everywhere, but are those states that you have familiarity with, do they tend to do better with foster youth and child protection in general, or are you not as familiar?
Well, I, for years, have tracked pretty closely all 50 states. And you know, if you look at California, for instance, which made an effort to fix this practice, but I seem to recall that I believe my least favorite governor, Governor Newsom, actually vetoed the bill that would have fixed this problem in California, which...
Yeah, I think so, too. And I'm like, I know he's vetoing some stuff that I don't like, which is great, but vetoing this? Like, that's ridiculous.
What makes it so important is that 20% of all kids in foster care are in California. California is sort of like the Uber state. It's the largest population of kids in care generally. You can look at any sector, any issue related to children, and look to California for a substantial sample. And then, of course, it's...
Is there a reason for that, for California being so central?
Well, just a big state. You know, it just has a big population. Yeah. You can look at almost any issue, children's mental health, education, or whatever, and look to California as an example. What also, though, further confuses the issues in California is that it is a county-based system. Most states have a state-based child welfare system, but a few, like California, Ohio, a few others, have county-based systems. So, you know, California is like, you know, a million different child welfare systems. But I think, to your question, what has driven reform in those states is not necessarily that they have good child welfare systems. It's that they have principled state legislators who have recognized that this practice is wrong and have, outside of the framework of the child welfare system, taken it on and pushed the ball across the goal line. That's really what has given me hope. And it's interesting because you and I talk all the time about state versus federal approaches to things. And, you know, with the tech stuff, you know, I generally wish the states would stand down in general and figure out how we can do a responsible federal policy. But in this case, it's been kind of interesting to watch the states push back on this in a principled way. And, you know, Governor Newsom, who is... certainly, I always describe him as my least favorite Democrat. But Governor Newsom has done a lot of virtue signaling about kids in California, various bills that he's pushed forward. But when it comes to the practice of protecting children, whether it's releasing pedophiles early from prison, you know, some of whom served 2 days in jail, or vetoing this bill, which is a substantial issue for kids in California, not so impressive, right? So I think that what's happening here that's sort of interesting is that it's kind of democracy in action, where we see these state reps who figure out what's going on and they build a movement and they get it done. And I'm quite certain that the child welfare agencies in those states are like, no, but it happens anyway. And really, you know, child welfare is a niche issue in the sense that the average state legislator or staffer, and this is even true in Congress, doesn't necessarily have that much subject matter expertise about it. And then whenever there's a discussion of reform, the governors come forward and generally say, you know, we already have so much to do in this regard. You know, don't make us do something else, or don't take our money away. And even if the money is really, as in this case, ill-gotten gains. So it's an interesting issue to work in, but it's a frustrating issue because at the end of the day, there hasn't been really any quality control. And so when you look at including the states that have taken this Social Security issue on, almost every state has been sued for the performance of their child welfare system. I was in D.C. for years. I'm from D.C. And I served on the court-appointed panel of the receiver that oversaw the D.C. child welfare system for a long time. And that was litigated for years and years. And, you know, what I saw was that most people's eyes glaze over. They just think, oh, my God, this looks so hard. There's nothing I can do about it. And I can't put any more pressure on the system because these people are already working hard. And that's true in a way. But the question then becomes, you can't just write off 20% of all the kids and say, well, gee, they're missing. We don't know where they are. They probably just ran away. I mean, typically, if a child is missing from the system, they're over 12 years old, they automatically classify them as a runaway. So it's an issue of quality control. And I think that this whole Social Security thing has been probably the most, I think, certainly the most troubling example of how we need to do a better job.
Yeah, this is one of those issues where I am read into it and I just can't believe it exists. And I get there sometimes with government, but usually not to the degree it is here, especially with, I think, what you really drove home for me was the example of like using the multiple Social Security numbers. So creating fraud for kids who have run away. So kids they're not even caring for and have, you know, lost the ability to care for, maybe their own fault for it. And that they just want to milk them for money. I think we're going to leave it there. But this was really helpful. And I think we're going to teach a lot of people about this. It was so interesting because in the Federalist Society working group and in the state and local working group, when I brought this up, no one could believe it. They were just like, hold on a sec. This is a real thing. So I'm so glad, Maureen, that you're able to join us and take the time to nerd with us today. And thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for sharing your time and expertise with us today, Maureen and Shoshana. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.